non-stop talk radio, streaming 24 hours a day. This is TalkZone.com. Today's compelling talk radio. It's the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com.
Ah, welcome in to the second portion of the Baum Show. Interesting conversation about work, wasn't it? You working too much? I didn't say enjoying it more or less. I just said, are you working too much? It's amazing how rarely we take a look at our what I call emotional thermometer and whether or not we're really happy and fulfilled with what we do. I only say that because I've always had the feeling that, and I have nothing to back this up, but I've always had the feeling that if you ask 10 people, do they really love, and I underline the word love, do they really love what they do? Out of every 10 people you ask that question to, 8 would say, So maybe the best advice you can give your kids or grandkids is, find something that you really love to do and would love to do every day and do it. All right. Let's move on. Second hour of the Baum Show. And once again, since this is my show, I will take a point of personal privilege to share with you some of the things of my growing up. And I remember a time when I was about ready to vote in my first presidential election. And prior to my first presidential vote way back when, I was warned that a vote for John Kennedy was a ballot for the Pope and that Vatican would run America. Now, there are many of you that are probably, are you serious? Yeah, I'm serious. You learn some interesting things in our lives, and that's one of the things I heard. I heard it from my parents. Matter of fact, especially my dad. My dad was very concerned about his liberal-thinking son back then and the fact that I thought this guy, John Kennedy, was really kind of like, I think the word then was hip, was really a hip guy. And this guy would bring a whole new sense of being an American president, a young, charismatic guy with great ideas, terrific-looking first lady, just a whole different view of what a president's supposed to look like. Because in those days, a president looked like Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower. But here's Jack Kennedy going, wow. And he was running against Richard Nixon, who was always sweating under his nose. I mean, he was a Paul, even though Jack Kennedy was a Paul. But he was a different kind of guy. But my parents said, along with other friends, be careful. If you vote for Jack Kennedy in this presidential campaign, the Vatican's going to run America. Many years later, a presidential candidate tells the nation he believes in religious freedom and his Mormon theology will not affect his running the country if. Who is he talking to? America's evangelical Christians, whose votes are the key to the Republican presidential nomination. That's who he's talking to. Who are these evangelicals? The butt of East Coast and West Coast jokes for decades? These evangelicals who helped turn the GOP into a political force during these Bush years? Are they just Bible-thumping zealots who dream of the Christian takeover of American culture? Let's ask Michael Lindsay, Rice University sociology professor and author of Faith in the Halls of Power, how evangelicals joined the American elite. Michael, welcome to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. It's nice to have you with us today.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
The inference in the title is evangelicals were on the outside looking in. When did the door start opening and why?
The real breaking point occurred in the summer of 76 when Jimmy Carter made the off-the-cuff remark that he was a born-again Christian. You remember he said this to a reporter.
I was reading Playboy at the time. I completely missed out on that.
Playboy came about 3 months later.
Okay.
But it clearly seared a moment in your mind. That came in October. But the comment that he made in that summer about being born again was followed about 3 weeks later with his opponent Gerald Ford announcing that he too was born again, and it seems the presidential candidates since then have been talking about their faith every 4 years. And that really has been what has galvanized evangelicalism kind of movement into the halls of power.
What turned you on to the myriad of interviews that are part of Faith in the Halls of Power? What were you looking for?
Well, I was really trying to find the number of evangelicals who are in powerful positions, and I thought I might be able to do 20 or 30 interviews, I guess, and in the end I did 360 of them. It's just amazing, and I really have to say I was surprised by it. I was trying to figure out how is it that evangelicals have become so prominent, because if you look at the numbers, the percentage of self-identified evangelicals actually has not grown over the last 30 years. It's between a quarter and a third of the adult population. So if that's the case, it makes you think, well, what could be causing this? Well, how could they be so prominent if their numbers are not growing? And my hunch was that it's because a group of leaders who are in really powerful positions were moving into these roles who are also evangelicals, and that had given the movement a lot more prominence and prestige.
We're talking about the evangelical religious movement in the United States. Our guest is Michael Lindsay, and once again, we invite you to join us as listeners or as callers on the Baum Show. Number is 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. I'm not an evangelical. I've watched the movement as a reporter and a talk show host and a businessman over the years with increasing interest. How would you define one? How would you define an evangelical?
Well, most of the time, folks confuse evangelicals with fundamentalists. So you have to get that.
They're not the same?
They're not the same. A fundamentalist comes into contact with secular society, and his natural inclination is to pull back, is to withdraw, to try and maintain the integrity of his faith. Whereas an evangelical comes into contact with secular society, and his natural inclination is to engage, is to evangelize. There are three kind of characteristics that identify evangelicals. One is that they believe in the importance of the Bible. It's the supreme religious authority for their life, so they're people of the book. Second is the importance of having a personal relationship with God through a born-again experience, and that can be a dramatic moment or a long process, but there comes a time where they own the faith themselves. And then third is the importance of having an active approach to faith. So faith actually changes the way they live their lives. They want to bear witness to it in word and deed.
When you say active approach, what does that really mean?
It means
showing up at church every Sunday?
Yeah, and talking about their faith and wanting their faith not to be a segment of their life, but to be incorporated into everything that they do.
So would that separate them in some ways from some of the other mainstream Western religions like Catholicism, Judaism, Protestantism?
Absolutely. Well, they fall, typically, they fall under the category of Protestantism, although you can have some evangelical Catholics, but typically, they are understood to be sort of a subcategory. Within Protestantism, there's two major streams, evangelical and what's called mainline, and the difference between those two is that evangelicals are much, much more interested in this sort of bearing witness component,
mm-hmm.
and they're also much more convinced of the importance of a born-again experience where they take ownership of the faith, where they own it themselves.
So you can't be a true evangelical unless you're active and go to church. I'm not talking about believing in the Bible and living by most of its tenets, but you really can't, by what you've said, you really can't be an active evangelical if you're not involved in the church as the center of your local society.
Well, that's the funny thing about it, Dave, is that actually among the people that I interviewed, these elite leaders, many of them understand themselves to be evangelicals, and yet they're not really connected to local church. They're not really involved in their church. Maybe they go, you know, but they're not really very active. Or some of them are just members in name only.
Why is there that distance? I mean, we'll get to that in more detail, some of the big hitters that you talk to, but why is there that distance?
I think part of it is that they have found alternative sources of spiritual support, so there are Bible studies, fellowship groups that have been really important to them that have helped them. And then also I think there's been a real kind of disengagement. They live a lifestyle that's not in the same place week in and week out, and so they're less likely to put down those solid roots. And they also are trying to sort of figure out many of them are frustrated with the senior pastors because they don't respect them as leaders. And so you've had all these things kind of going in together.
So their secular status, success in business and otherwise, has kind of distanced them to whatever degree from the true definition of evangelicalism.
Well, you see, we can't make the collapse. So I actually am not saying that the active approach to faith means that you have to be active in a local house of worship.
Okay.
So you don't have to do that, although that typically is what we associate with evangelicals. It's more that the idea is that faith permeates all of your life. It's brought into everything that you do. It's not just segmented to one segment of your life.
With Michael Lindsay on the Baum Show, as we begin the initial phase of our conversation about faith in the halls of power, evangelicals in the United States, the one thing I've never truly understood is the term saved, being saved. I would think that somebody of a different religious persuasion would believe in his or her mind that in their own way that they've been saved. Why is this taken on such a larger-than-life mantra within evangelicalism?
Well, because evangelicals are people of the Bible, that the they study the Bible a lot, they use some of the same kind of language, and so there are lots of encounters where Jesus in his worldly ministry talks about salvation has come to your house, or that this is what you must do to be saved, and so that kind of language actually comes straight out of the Bible. And evangelicals have just appropriated it. And it's come to mean sort of the idea that you have recognized the need for God and you want that to be part of your life. And so getting saved is sort of a process of having an awareness of the importance of faith and saying that this is something you want to be personally important in your own life.
Is that a rebaptism, as it were? And the reason I mention that, as a guy whose whole adult life has been covering news and reporting on it, and you hear these stories almost every day. A guy gets arrested and thrown in jail, and then a month to a year to 6 months to 6 years in jail, he finds God and is saved. And you kind of wonder, I think, if you're not an evangelical, whether or not this is some kind of a cop-out for people on the outside who say, oh, okay, he's all right now. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. And I would say that kind of the most evangelicals, if you ask them, about that, on that particular issue, getting saved is one thing, but that doesn't mean that you've paid the full price on your crimes or whatever. So evangelicals are pretty tough on crime. But there are a lot of kind of, as you say, prison cell conversions. The idea of getting rebaptized, there is certainly with them, this is where you see that mainline evangelical split. So mainliners typically baptize infants, as a way of sort of saying they're part of the, the faith community, whereas evangelicals tend not to do that because they say you gotta make the decision yourself. So there does come there are some people who are baptized as infants and then they start going to an evangelical church and they come to a point where they say, okay, this is how I want to orient my life. And so the church says, well, because of that, the next step is for you to get baptized. So there are a lot of rebaptisms that happen around the country. But at the same time, that actually for evangelicals doesn't have any kind of evangelicals have what we call a low liturgy, so they don't really think of the process of getting baptized as being that big a deal. It's not; it's mainly symbolic. It doesn't have any other kind of salvific power that, let's say, Roman Catholics would believe. Mm-hmm. So that it's just sort of a public act, and it does happen.
Did you find in your research that the evangelicals had a true deep respect for other religions?
In the book I talk about two kinds of evangelicals. One group are what we call populist evangelicals. And these are what you see on the TV most of the time. These are the folks who say we got to take back the country for Christ. And they see themselves as culture warriors who are in opposition with secular society. And many times these folks are quite bombastic in their response. They're protesters and they're constantly struggling against other faith traditions.
Are these usually religious leaders?
They are religious leaders, but you also have a lot of the average people in the pews who would fit into this category of populist evangelicals.
Okay.
Then there's another category that I call cosmopolitan evangelicals. And I found these were actually much more prominent among the business, political, and cultural elite that I interviewed. That they didn't see themselves as in quite such the same way. They weren't culture warriors. They didn't see themselves in opposition. And they still wanted to sort of have their faith to be winsome and attractive, but they were also concerned about their faith being seen as legitimate and authentic. And so they didn't have the same kind of harsh language about other religious traditions. And here's where you see a really important divide between the cosmopolitan and the populist.
Well, the reason I mention that is obviously one of the big issues is the presidential election in 2008. And what's really intriguing to me, and I think to most observers, regardless of what your religious persuasion is the fact that Mitt Romney had to go public to try to convince, obviously for political reasons, that he's an okay guy to evangelicals so that he can get their vote as a bona fide Republican. And yet some evangelical leaders say that they're leery, not necessarily of Romney the man, but of Mormonism. That's really what led me to my initial question about whether or not there is a respect for other religions. Because I didn't get the feeling in Romney leading up to all this with all the ballyhoo that there was a real strong positive feeling from evangelicals toward Mormonism. I don't know what might be the fear, and maybe you can clarify that, but you see where I'm going?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, clearly Romney did not want to give that speech. He was pushed into having to do it because he was slipping in the polls in Iowa and was concerned about how South Carolina might look as well. And it was a strategically smart move for him to give that talk, especially as a Massachusetts politician giving a talk like John F. Kennedy did in 1960 in Texas, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really what I find is that it's certainly possible for evangelicals to feel okay voting for a Mormon because they have worked with Mormons on a lot of broad political coalitions around the pro-life movement, opposing same-sex marriage, opposing violence among children's television programming. I mean, there's lots of things that they've worked together on. The question and the real challenge that Romney faces right now is not to convince the evangelical Republican base that they can vote for a Mormon, but that they can vote for this Mormon. And his strong suit is to be able to compare himself to the rest of the Republican field. Up until 3 weeks ago, his main competition was Rudy Giuliani, and you couldn't find a more religiously unmusical candidate than Rudy
well
Giuliani.
Put.
Yeah. So
right.
He just doesn't get it. And I think that Romney fares very well among the faithful when he's compared to Giuliani.
What's the fear, though, from the evangelical standpoint? What is it about Mormonism? Much like, as I said in my introduction to you, much like the feeling that I got from my parents and others about Jack Kennedy and the Vatican would run Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I don't think evangelicals think that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you know, executive committee is going to be calling the shots on American foreign policy. But I think that there is a mystique to the LDS Church, and evangelicals don't like mystique. They like things black and white.
This is important to know. What you can see, touch, feel, and hear, right?
That's right.
Nothing gray, black or white.
That's right, black and white. And so since they feel like there's something that they don't understand, and it's simple things. You know, if you're not a Mormon, you cannot enter a Mormon temple. Well, that runs really counter to evangelicals' notion that everybody should be welcome at church.
Okay, that television series doesn't help either, does it?
So you've got all these kinds of different ways that evangelicals are curious about Mormonism, and I think that the challenge right now is that Romney and Huckabee are really fighting for the same constituencies.
We're talking to Michael Lindsay, who is the author of Faith in the Halls of Power, How Evangelicals Joined the American Elite. We've got a long way to go. 1-888-463-6748 on the Dave Baum Show. That's 1-888-463-6748. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about a culture, the evangelical culture, and whether or not it's being changed or reshaped. Stick around.